This is Amy Poehler. My new movie, Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, is coming to theaters June 14th, and it's making me feel joy and sadness and anger, definitely some disgust,
Rose,
and I think a little fear.
Really?
But I'm also feeling these new emotions like anxiety, embarrassment, envy, and ennui.
It's what you call the boredom.
Okay, that one was weird. It's going to be the feel-everything movie of the summer. Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, only in theaters June 14th. Get tickets now.
I'm Dave Baker.
And I'm Spandrew Spice.
Welcome to Deep Cuts, the podcast where we pick a topic and walk you through the ins, the outs, and the nitty-gritty so that you can appear like an interesting and idiosyncratic person at your next forced social function. Today's topic is...
The Boone Island Cannibals.
Who were the Boone Island Cannibals? In December of 1710, a British merchant vessel shipwrecked 6 miles off the coast of Maine. All 14 crew members initially survived, but winter conditions with no fire or food on a barren outcrop led to one of society's most ultimate taboos.
Oh my God, we're back again. Act 1, From the Earth to the Boone. Boone Island is a desolate, rocky location 6 miles from the coast of York, Maine. At low tide, the island is approximately 300 feet by 700 feet. It currently houses the tallest lighthouse in New England, which stands at 137 feet high. English Puritan lawyer and one of the leaders of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, John Winthrop, mentioned sailing past Boone Island in the 1600s. The island is known for being the site of numerous shipwrecks. The first important wreck is where the island gets its English name. Coastal trading ship Increase wrecked on the island in the summer of 1682. The ship's 4 survivors, 3 Europeans and 1 Native American, survived solely on fish and seagull eggs. They were on the island for a month when they noticed smoke coming from a fire on the nearby Mount Agamenticus in York, Maine. The survivors started a fire which was noticed by those on the mountain, who soon rescued the castaways. They viewed their rescue as a boon from God, so they dubbed it Boone Island. But 19th century New England-based poet Celia Thaxter once described Boone Island as the forlornest place that can be imagined. As the daughter of a lighthouse keeper and the author of My Lighthouse and Other Poems, she was somewhat of an expert on barren, rocky islands.
I love the idea that... I love the idea that there's just like a subgenre of lighthouse poetry, you know?
That's like the shoegaze or like the goth music or like the...
Yeah, it's like a subgenre of like pirate shanty songs, you know?
If pirate shanties are like the electronica, then lighthouse poetry is the doom goth subgenre of it.
And I love the idea that like, you know, what's her name? Celia Thaxter. I love the idea that like Celia Thaxter would be like the Nepo baby of the burgeoning, you know, New England lighthouse poetry scene where people are like, you don't even truly love lighthouses. You were born in one. Like you don't even know.
That's not what it would be. It would be like that she presents herself as this like super indie lighthouse poet. And everybody thinks that she's like this really cool, really indie person. And then some guy on, you know, 17th century TikTok is like, actually, did you know that Celia Thaxter is actually a Nepo baby?
Yeah. And then it's you know what it is? It's like the 1700s equivalent or 1600 equivalent of that is like him just like going to the local butter churn place and like gossiping with people. There's like some woman who's just like, I don't care. I'm trying to churn this fucking butter. Leave me alone. And he's like, no, you don't even understand. Celia Thaxter is here for the clout. She's not even really a fucking lighthouse poet, all right? She was born in one. She's just using it for the clout.
Yes, Celia Thaxter is the fucking king princess of the 1600s.
Yeah. She and the guy that's spreading all these rumors is that dude on TikTok who's constantly like, insert musical artist here is a Nepo baby and they fucking suck and here's why. And it's like, bro.
Yeah, honestly, I hate that guy. I like, it's funny that you brought that up because I hate that guy. Like, because it's like, the things he's saying are not technically wrong. Like, he's not incorrect. And it's also, I think valuable to understand that, that like certain people have just gotten these advantages because their families are rich or they're literally in the industry. Like, you know, him talking about the Strokes and how they seem like they're this like indie, like group of like street hooligans or whatever, but they're actually just all from like mega rich families and musician families. Like that's not incorrect. But I don't know. There's something about somebody who's just built their entire brand off of like, I'm going to point out this information that you could easily Google and pretend like I'm like educating the world when I'm really just trying to build my own channel and get views is just, it just annoys me.
Yeah. I mean, what's the thing that he always says? Self-made is a toxic myth. And it's like, yeah. Okay. Yes. All right. But like, what else do you have to say? Like, that guy's videos pop up all the time, and they're always...
You repeat the same thing over and over again, which is like, I Googled this person's family and found out that they are rich, and I'm going to make another video saying the exact same thing.
Yeah, and like you said, like, I agree also. Like, it's frustrating how some people are just born on third base. But at the end of the day, like, what are you going to do about it? Like, do you want to sit here and just complain about how everyone else is born with a head start, or put your fucking nose to the grindstone and try and make some shit, you know? Like,
that's what it totally feels like with that guy. It feels like, it just seems like he, because he's a musician, and it just feels like he got frustrated that he wasn't making any headway in the industry. And then he made one video about this and he saw line go up. He's like, oh my God, I got 1 million views for saying that. And then he just leaned into it. And now his life has become focusing on how others are more fortunate than him and building like a whole brand around that.
Which is probably not even what that person's real life is like. Like, they're probably not even focused on that in their real day-to-day existence, right? But because they got that positive feedback on it, now they're just out here Celia Thaxtering around, being like, you don't understand lighthouse culture the way I do.
These are called one-star conversations from now on, because these are why we get one-star reviews on iTunes. Boone Island received its first beacon, a precursor to a lighthouse, in 1799. As it was made of wood, the beacon only lasted 5 years on the island. In 1811, its first stone lighthouse was erected, which was 32 feet above the water. 20 years later, it was rebuilt to stand 49 feet above the water. That's kind of crazy, because like that doesn't happen now. Like, that's not how infrastructure really works. But like, to think back on not that long ago, like, you know, a couple hundred years ago, where they were just regularly have to rebuild cities to like, number one, keep up with like advancing technologies, but also because just the building materials they use were inherently much more they broke down or wore much faster. Whereas now, like, we build things to last, you know, a long time.
Yeah, well, we're also not building shit with like literally a screwdriver. You know? Like, you know, if you had a fucking nail gun back then, that you'd have been burned at the stake for witchcraft. Motherfuckers just out here with their little shoes with buckles on them and giant hats, you know, fucking John Standishing around. You show up with like a tool belt. They're like, what witchcraft is this?
I honestly think in that case, they wouldn't do it, though. Like, in that case, like, they would start to do it. Like, they would have the guy with the nail gun and they would still be like, heretic. And they'd be like, wait a minute, what does that thing do?
Fuck it. I'm converting to black magic. I want a home.
They're just like, this shit's dope.
I love the idea too that like everybody just dresses like a Quaker, but then there's like one or two modern things about how they dress, like, you know, oh, we got to get old William Standing to come down here and help us build this fucking church, and he shows up with like a fanny pack. It's completely 1700s get up, but the fanny pack. Like, what is that? What is that ungodly contraption around your waist, William? And he's like, oh, it's a fanny pack. Look, you can put all kinds of stuff in it.
They're just, no, the fanny pack is the thing. Or they're just like, we must arrest this heretic. Wait a minute, what is that? Oh, it's a fanny pack. What is this fanny pack? Why'd you pronounce it like that? I just said it. Just fucking tell us. Well, you know, it's a little thing. You strap it around your waist. Comes from the British version of fanny, which is actually your is actually the front of you as opposed to the back of you. For some reason, we got that backwards when we came over here on the Mayflower. We flipped the script on that one, but yeah, you put it on your front and you just zips open and you just store stuff in it. And they're just like, "Oh my God, this is a miracle! You're not a heretic; you're a man of Christ."
The reason why we live in this puritanical Judeo-Christian hellscape today is because one guy wore a fanny pack. Yeah. The first cult in America was actually the cult of fanny pack.
Mm-hmm, yeah. A lot of people don't know that. They think because it's such an established mainstream religion, they just think of it ubiquitously. But when you really think about it, it's basically a cult.
Yeah, it's basically a cult. You know that? Like, it's basically.
Yeah, when you really think about it, if you're really thinking about it, fanny packianity is actually a cult.
If you ever went to the Vatican and you fucking popped up under the Pope's little dress thing, he's got like four fanny packs in there. You don't even know.
A lot of little boys saw that.
And now we're moving on.
Hey, man, fight the real power. R.I.P. Sinead O'Connor.
Yeah, agreed.
Then in 1845, the tallest lighthouse in New England was erected, 137 feet above sea level. Because of its desolate location, lighthouse keepers willing to live there are few and far between, with many arriving and departing shortly after. Only one keeper truly enjoyed his time there, William C. Williams. William C. Williams tended the lighthouse for 27 years and lived until he was over 90. 1978 saw one of the harshest blizzards in New England history. Two keepers took shelter inside the light chamber, while every other structure was demolished. The day after, they were rescued by a helicopter. The Coast Guard then repaired the tower and installed solar panels so that the light could be automated.
And then here's a little photo guy. All right, so we're looking at this island. That shit is bleak. And calling that shit an island is a little bit of an overstatement. That shit looks like it's maybe 50 feet wide and maybe 60, 70 feet long. We got a light tower in the middle of the island and then two structures, a red brick structure and a gray brick structure with a roof, and then the solar panels. And man, this looks like some sort of forced celibacy prison camp or something, where it's just like, nah, bruh, here, live on this fucking island.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like being a lighthouse keeper would be the creepiest, loneliest job ever. Like, you have to be either, which is probably the case, this was probably the main motivating factor for most people, especially during this time. You have to either be in such poverty and financial dire straits that like any job you will take, or you have to just be like a very specific type of person who just literally has zero interest in human interaction or any kind of emotional warmth whatsoever. Because you're not just alone. You're not just like, oh, I'm living in my apartment. You're alone with a capital A. You're so alone that you're not alone. You're with like the fucking Shoggoth old ones that permeate the fucking stratosphere. Like there's Lovecraftian beasts watching you out here.
Yeah, it's so bleak. Like there's not even like a tree or a bush on this little island thing. It's like, there's not even sand. It's just rocks and water. Yeah, I don't know, man. Could you do this? Could you live on something like this?
Absolutely not. The isolation is fine. Like, I wouldn't care about the being alone part, but the location. I would be terrified to be out there by myself. Like I get like very creeped out very easily when I'm alone. When I'm with somebody, like, I don't care. Like one of the scariest nights I've ever had was I was living in Santa Cruz, and at the time I had a paper route, so my job was just like delivering newspapers out in these wooded communities in Santa Cruz, California. And basically, like, I would go out at 1 a.m. So like my job, like, I'd be at the house all day, hang out with my roommates, and then I would leave at 1 and come back at like. And so I'm hanging out and we watched this movie called The Fourth Kind, which was like this kind of shitty horror movie with Mila Jovovich, where it was presented as if it was based on a true story. And it had like kind of an interesting mechanic where it pretended like it was this real story that happened. And there was like a total kayfabe in the movie where it starts out Mila Jovovich like being interviewed, and she's like, the following movie was based off of this real event that happened. and we're going to show some of the real footage from the events or whatever. And then it would show like the dramatization with Mila Jovovich and the actors playing the characters. And then it would sometimes show what was supposed to be like caught on camera footage of the real people. So they had like actors who were like playing the real life versions of the people who are in the movie, like as the actors playing them. And it presented it like it was like all this footage that they found that they were like kind of cross cutting, but it was all fake. And it was not scary. It was dumb. And we watched the movie and I was like, oh, that was fucking stupid. And then I went out and I got in my car and I drove out and picked up my papers. And then I went out to these like desolate wooded areas at 1 a.m. And I was like, suddenly that movie was the scariest fucking thing I ever saw in my life. And I was like, I was so terrified. I was like creeped out the whole night. I was like driving around by myself in the woods at 2 a.m. And I'm just like, the fucking aliens are going to get me.
Mila Jovovich is going to get me.
Yeah, Mila Jovovich. So yeah, if I was out here, like, I would be fucking terrified. This would be the scariest shit to me.
Yeah, I also would not choose to do this.
But I think for a lot of people, the isolation would be the thing. Like, I think most people aren't as creeped out when they're by themselves as I am, for whatever reason. But most people need human interaction in a way that I don't necessarily. On New Year's Day in 1711, the York County coroner was called upon to examine a frozen body found among a mess of seawood in Wells, Maine. The gaunt body was covered in sores and clearly died while trying to make it to land in a makeshift raft found not too far away. Boone Island was clearly the best candidate for where the body came from. I mean, this is reminding me of our conversation from, I think it was the Molasses Massacre episode about future privilege. This episode's really reminded me of future privilege, because it's like when you lived back in these times, it was just like your life was just mostly misery. And like there was maybe some moments of joy, but it was like the neutral resting state of existence was misery. It was like you had to do miserable jobs in order to make money to survive, like fucking live in a lighthouse on a little desolate plot of land with nothing and no one. And like freezing to death was just like, the question was like, am I not going to freeze to death today? That was the question.
Yeah. Is today where I survive? Can I fucking survive?
Yeah, like this shit was bleak. Coroner Lewis Bain went to Cape Natick and convinced local fisherman John Stover to take him to Boone Island. Lewis John and his first mate then set sail for the island 6 miles away. Upon getting closer, they noticed a white object on the island's highest point. As they approached the island, the white object turned out to be a white tent flapping in the breeze. Stover navigated the boat as close as he could get and dropped anchor, then boarded a canoe to the island. The three men all had beards and no overcoats. Captain John Dean identified himself and told them to either evacuate the men or come ashore and build a fire. When Stover stepped on the island, he was shocked to see the captain covered in sores, but what he saw inside the white tent left him speechless. Two, Bad Boone Rising. Captain John Dean was born in Nottingham, Nottinghamshire, East Midlands, England. I know that's not actually funny, and anybody who's from the UK is like, what? What are you laughing about? That struck me as funny. Sorry, your fucking names of your cities are weird. Captain John Dean was born in Nottingham, Nottinghamshire, East Midlands, England in 1679. He grew up in relative poverty and apprenticed to a butcher as a teenager. 19th century writer W.H.G. Kingston wrote that Dean rose to the rank of captain in the Royal Navy and participated in the capture of Gibraltar during the War of the Spanish Succession. After leaving the Royal Navy, he became a merchant sailor. Here's the thing. Say what you want about the United States. And, you know, we portray ourselves as the best country in the world. And a lot of people are critical of that and say we're not the best country in the world. And there's all these problems. But one thing I'll say we got right was we just shortened shit. That was a mouthful. All those names of wars, like in the U.S., we're just like, your name is Bob Smith. You're from Kentucky. That's about as complex as our names are going to get here.
Yeah, I mean, we only just take the names of their names.
Yeah, but then we fucking shorten them.
No, we don't. We put new in front of it. We're so unimaginative that we just do, oh, you got a place called York? How about New York. Oh, you got Hampshire? Hampshire? We're going to fuck it up and call it New Hampshire.
Yeah, but newer is better.
Future privilege, baby. Future privilege.
With the help of his father and brother, Dean was able to purchase a small merchant ship, which he christened the Nottingham Galley. On September 10th, 1710, the Nottingham Galley set sail for Ireland from London with a cargo of rope. It was one of the many merchant ships in the convoy protected by two Royal Navy warships, as the War of the Spanish Succession was still raging. The Nottingham Galley separated from the convoy and sailed to Killybegs, where Dean intended to add butter and cheese to his cargo. But the crew spotted two sails likely belonging to French privateers. Two different versions of the events exist, with Dean claiming to intend to invade the privateers, but the crew claimed that he attempted to sail towards the privateers, hoping to be captured in order to collect the ship's insurance policy. In addition to believing he was a traitor, Dean was a sadistic captain and once beat two sailors so badly they couldn't work for a month. With a threat of mutiny, the Nottingham Galley left Ireland and headed to North America. Reaching Canada, which was then controlled by the French, the ship spent a week off the coast of Newfoundland. When the crew spotted sails coming towards them again, instead of fleeing, Dean opened the bar to the crew and donned his finest clothes, likely expecting a French ship, but the ship turned out to be an English galley. Likely let down, Dean had the Nottingham Galley sail down the coast, where they ran into a sleet storm in the Gulf of Maine on December 10th, 1710. Dean beat Langman bloody and set course for land. The next day, the Nottingham Galley struck Boone Island and splintered into pieces. The crew were able to remove the mast and use it to crawl on to safely reach the island. Yeah, you know, that's interesting because that's, you know, that's similar to how this show works, where, you know, we do the show. And if we ever have like a disagreement on a direction, like a type of episode we should do, or like when we should do a certain thing or something in the story, you just beat me to a bloody pulp until I just relent and let you do it your way.
Yeah, that's definitely what happens. That's definitely what happens. As the one of us who's a foot and a half shorter and made of skin and bones, yes, definitely what happens. I'm like the podcast equivalent of a power bottom, really. I don't even really know what that means. I mean, like in this context, I'm not quite sure what that means, but it's very funny to me.
I mean, it checked out to me. It made sense to me. All I'm saying is, every once in a while, you go full of mice and men and tell me about the rabbits.
That's true.
We got another picture of this lighthouse. It's kind of the same as the other one, though.
Yeah, it's the other side of the lighthouse. But now you can see that one of the structures is a little house made of fucking particle board. That shit looks so cold.
That has zero insulation. You'd think that, like, because like this is like a modern day view of it, and it's supposed to be like, oh, this is how it is, and like now they have a house at least. You'd think that they would have splurged a little bit more on the house construction. This thing looks like a Lincoln log house,
dude. A Lincoln log house looks like it would have been more insulated.
Yeah, there'd be a little bit more insulation from those little logs, whatever those are made out of, wood, I guess.
Yeah, that particle board shit. No thanks. That also just looks like it. You get like splinters from looking at it wrong.
Yeah. If you get out of bed wrong in the morning, your whole body is just filled with splinters.
That's why so many of the lighthouse keepers die there, is because they get like Bob Marley'd. They get like feet infections, you know, from like walking around and getting splinters in their bobs of their feet and shit.
Yeah. Their feet are like pin cushions.
Yeah. This sounds like a Clive Barker story. Feet pin cushion man. He didn't realize how erotic it would be until he stepped foot into Forlorn Island, where no one could see him squirm under the delicious, I mean, painful splinters.
Yeah, it's like a story about a lighthouse keeper who gets splinters in his feet, and then he just like derives sexual pleasure from like picking them out. And every time he like picks one out, he like opens a rift into hell wider. Act 3, Dark Side of the Boon. All 14 crew members of the Nottingham Galley survived the crash and made it ashore, but the ship and most of its cargo were lost to the sea. They used the sail to make a makeshift tent for some semblance of shelter. They also found some cheese and beef bones that managed to float ashore. On the first day, Langman killed a seal, which they ate raw because they couldn't start a fire. The second night, the ship's cook died, whose body they pushed into the sea. They found a few mussels and even cowhide, which they cut up and swallowed. Langman killed the second seagull, which they ate again raw. Dang, that like fucking second day your cook dies? Like the main thing you're worried about is like eating. And you're just like, man, this is going to be rough. But at least we have somebody who knows how to like cobble together ingredients to make something edible that we can kind of eat and like nourish ourselves without being totally disgusting and get through this. And then day two, he's like, ugh, I could have turned that seagull into a foie gras.
I've got an idea for how to do ratatouille with a shoe leather. Fuck, he's dead.
I had an idea about how to do a ratatouille with a shoe leather. It would have been delicious and nutritious. It would have been surprisingly delicious in a way that you would have never thought that leather could be.
Well, I guess we don't have a choice. Hand me that leather. Let's just eat it.
Let's get it wet. Let's get this down.
They're like trying to convince each other that like seawater makes it tastier. George, just dip the cheese in the seawater. It's actually not too bad.
And the irony that they're, as you know, spoiler alert, they're getting to the place where they're going to start partaking of the forbidden meat. But the cook of all people, they kicked into the ocean.
Yeah, he probably could have helped them flambé that human.
Being only 6 miles from shore, the castaways could see ships sailing into and out of Portsmouth Harbor when the weather was clear. That's fucked up. Because like nowadays, it's like, you know, you get lost at sea or you get stranded on an island or something like that. When that kind of stuff happens, you got to be like totally isolated. That's because, you know, if otherwise you could just like use a cell phone and just be like, hey, bruh, kind of need some help over here. But back then, like they weren't even that far away from civilization. They could see the ships. They just had zero way of contacting them.
It's my nightmare. No, thank you.
Like that would be fucked. Because at least if you're totally stranded out in the middle of nowhere, like you get it. You're like, ah, fuck, we're fucked. Like there's nobody around. But to sit there and be able to watch people within eyesight and just still be fucked was probably utter torture.
I wonder if there's a way, because 6 miles is a long ass distance to swim. But I wonder if there's a way to train for that. Like if you did laps around the island for like a couple months, would you increase your endurance to the fact that you could make it all the way there? But then you don't have any food, so it's not like you're, so it's just like burning fake, you know, it's burning calories you don't have.
Yeah, you can't, yeah, there's no way for you to train or do anything like that because you have no fuel. But also I think the water is probably freezing cold. The other guy tried to make it to the shore and he frozen to death, basically. Three ships sailed near Boone Island, but the castaways couldn't get their attention. A Swedish crewman slapped together a raft and sail and set off for the mainland with another sailor. The Swede was never seen again, but the other sailors' bodies washed up ashore, eventually leading to their rescue. That Swedish guy was D.B. Cooper.
Yeah, D.B. Cooper is a fucking Highlander.
And every couple hundred years, he just like appears somewhere and then just like jumps off a plane and disappears again.
Here we are. We're jumping out of a plane one more time.
That's the better Highlander 2. That's what they should have done.
Yeah, yeah, they should have just made Connor McLeod into D.B. Cooper. Yeah.
The plot of that movie is so fucking weird.
That movie fucking sucks. The Renegade Cut is significantly better, but it still fucking sucks.
Just the idea that like there's a movie about a immortal ancient warrior who travels across the globe fighting and killing other warriors in order to gain the ultimate power. And then the sequel is like, now he's an old scientist who built a dome around the earth that blocked the sun out.
And he's an alien.
I mean, that's the part that everyone hates. But just the setup for the movie is fucking strange to me. That they're like, now he's like an old guy with a wife and he's like a famous scientist. Like that's
they completely change what the quickening is. Like it's no longer ultimate knowledge. Now it's just like stuff. It's not anything in the sequel. In the first movie, it's like the ability to communicate with anybody anywhere in the world and spread knowledge and help, you know, unifying into world peace basically is what they insinuate at the end of the movie, right? And then the second movie, they're just like, actually, it's just going to bring back Sean Connery?
Yeah. And also it's like his, universal knowledge he uses to like build this dome around the earth to block out the sun. And then everyone's like mad at him for it. It's like, it's a weird idea for a sequel to what the Highlander is. It's a fucking weird idea. Not in a good way.
No, not in a good way. But it's interesting though, because all of the Highlander theatrical sequels never really explore the quickening or any of the mechanisms of the Highlander world in any interesting way. But the TV show really does. Like, the TV show has it introduces this idea of like...
My boy Duncan.
Yeah, with Duncan.
America runs on Duncan.
Yes. Adrian Paul plays Duncan MacLeod. But the show is really cool because it like introduces this idea of like light and dark quickenings, and you can absorb knowledge, or like the idea that if you kill an evil Highlander, you become like them and you have their knowledge and you take on their personality traits is really cool. And that should, it's such a great logical extension of the stuff from the movies. And they just never do that. Like when, you know, Connor kills the Kurgan, like, it's fine. He's like, sick. There's no real downside to killing this guy. It's all good. Like, it's really interesting that he would have maybe taken on some of the negative aspects and had the negative memories, and like, that'd be really cool, but they don't do that.
Well, if you listen to the DVD commentary for the movies, I don't think they were thinking that deeply about it.
No, definitely not.
Like there's a sex scene in Highlander 2, and in the DVD commentary, it's the Renegade cut. Or no, it's not the it is the Renegade cut, but there's the sex scene in the movie, and they're like, this was a reshoot because we shot the movie and we realized that there wasn't any hot sex scenes in it. So we went and shot this as a pickup, which I thought that was so funny that they were just like nowadays, all these reshoots for MCU movies are they're just like, we shot this movie and it fucking sucks. We got to go in and like reshape this shit. But back then they were just like, this movie isn't hot enough. We got to go give us $50,000 to go shoot a sex scene, please.
Not to have a shameless plug here, but as you can tell from this conversation, I'm a little bit obsessed with the Highlander films and TV series. And in the back matter of Halloween Boy 2, there's like a 3,000 word essay that I wrote all about the movie Highlander and how it's a metaphor for Russell Mulcahy's gay relationships, and it's great, and the behind-the-scenes kerfluffle of Highlander 2. So if you want more of me riffing about Highlander, there's a bunch of it in the back of Halloween Boy 2.
Born to be kings. Oh, yeah, I love that song.
Me too.
But, like, I canonically love that song.
Oh, that's right. Yes, you do.
The weather got worse, with snow covering the island, freezing the men's clothes to their bodies. The ship's carpenter, a big man of 47, fell silent and died that night. Man, they're fucking batting zero on this. All the people that are survived are their shitty, abusive captain. And the people that are dying are, like, cook, carpenter, any person who could provide any kind of value that would help you survive. They're the first to die. There's like, oh, shit, like our cook died last week and now our carpenter died. What are we going to do, Captain? And he's like, I don't fucking know. All I know how to do is beat people near to death. My skill set does not apply here. You want me to beat you to death? I could do that. Like, I guess I could. That's what I could do. I could like put people out of their misery by beating them to death. Does that sound good? Does that sound like something you want?
Yes, Daddy. I mean, wait, no, no, we're trying to survive and get off this island.
Oh, no, Captain, I swabbed the deck wrong. Please don't beat me up to a near pulp. I would hate that.
No, Daddy. I mean, Captain, please don't take it out on my bussy. I mean, face.
Just like a BDSM pirate who just like fucks up on purpose so that their captain will beat them up.
Longshanks, what are you doing wearing that strange leather face mask? Why is there a zipper on it? Longshanks, I can't hear you. Unzip your face mask. I don't know, I just felt in the mood for it. Longshanks, swab the poop deck. I can think of something you can do to my poop deck. Zip.
The crew claimed that it was Dean's idea to cannibalize the carpenter.
What a fucking transition from... us talking about pirate gimps and poop decks too, and then he fucking cannibalized the carpenter.
Yeah, which like of course that was his idea. Like that, I mean that's what he's been lying in wait for an opportunity to do this for years. He's like, oh shit, I guess we gotta eat somebody. Fuck. This is gonna be so bad. Since he trained as a butcher's apprentice, he was the most qualified to go at it. He removed the carpenter's head, hands, and feet so the body wouldn't appear as human. He disemboweled the body and cut the breast into strips. Dean then wrapped a few of the strips in seaweed and distributed it to the crew. Three refused to eat their former shipmate, but were the first to eat in the morning. The remaining 10 crew members survived without a fire and the most limited of rations for 24 days.
So they're eating raw human for 24 days? Dude. Cannibalism, I'm sure, is fucking brutal. And I'm sure it's brutal with a fire where you can cook that shit. But raw? That is next level. No, I don't want to do that.
Yeah. Well, funny enough, I think we've actually discussed this on the show before. This has already been a thing we've talked about. I have to say that I think if we were in this situation, I think I would just have to go ahead and sacrifice myself and let you eat me. Even if I wanted to be selfish and be like, no, I'm going to survive and insist on eating you, the max I would survive is 8 hours. Like, listen, Dave, I tell you this every day that you're looking like a snack, but literally you are just a snack.
Yeah, it's basically just like my calves. You've got my calves and then that's about it. Like, there's nothing else.
So I would just have to sacrifice myself, because at least you could survive for the 24 days.
Yeah, you know how it's like, oh, we cut the breast into strips. Yeah, there is no strips. It's just rib cage with me. There's
you're a strip. You're a Dave strip.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm like one of those little like convenience store beef jerky sacks.
Yeah, you're a Slim Jim for sure. Slim Dave. Snap into a Slim Dave. Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. Look at that technically man who looks like a small boy with anorexia. Let's make him into a fucking processed food snack.
There's a corporate Twitter page about you that just shit posts all day.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's just like a fun coquettish cartoony version of my face, like doing the thumbs up. No, it's the doing you think I'm going to say no. It's like, you know, you think I'm going to say no to cannibalism? ?
Oh yeah. I'm a vegetarian. I haven't eaten meat in years.
We know.
But before I was a vegetarian, I think it was back in 2009. I worked at Circuit City, and Circuit City went out of business, and so I worked there during the whole closure of the company. So I was like working at the location in Bakersfield, California during the whole like going out of business sale and shutting down and all that stuff. And during that like last month or whatever it was, as the company was shutting down, it was like a total chaotic free for all where we were just like selling off all the stuff in the store. There was just like zero fucks were given. Sometimes like people would just like fucking come to work and then they would just like hang out in the back room. And like sometimes I was just like in the middle of working, I would just be like, I don't feel like being here anymore, and I would just like leave. But also there was like, they were no longer just giving a shit about anything that was happening. And so I would just like freely eat of this food in the store. Cause like, you know, in the front, they would have the rack that had all like the little snacks and things like that. And there would be different, and there were like drink cases and stuff like that. And I just like was freely eating of it. I would just like grab energy drinks and drink them and all this stuff during the day. And one of the things was that I would like during that time, and never before have I ever done this, and never before after, but I was just like pounding like 10 Slim Jims a day. Like I would just like get these Slim Jims and I would just fucking eat them throughout the day.
Was that good? Was that a good experience for you?
No, not really. It was just like, I was at work. This was like obviously over a decade ago. I was in my early 20s. I was also super poor and I was just like, oh, I can just eat this fucking food. And they just had all these Slim Jims and I was just pounding these. And no, it was not a good experience. It was just, that was disgusting. That was gross. I would never do that now.
Yeah, it sounds terrible. That sounds almost as bad as being forced to eat your fucking cook or, you know, your carpenter or whoever the fuck they ate.
Easily as bad of an experience as being forced to cannibalize your crewmates.
Pretty much. Future privilege, am I right?
When John Stover arrived on Boone Island, Dean led him to the makeshift white tent. Inside, he saw seven men huddled together for warmth, all sick and covered in sores. One castaway later wrote that Stover was shocked by
the ghastly figure of so many objects with long beards, nothing but skin and bone, wild, staring eyes, and countenances fierce, barbarous, unwashed, and infected with human gore.
Jesus Christ, that's like a mayhem lyric. It's like a Swedish black metal lyric.
The ghastly figure of so many objects, with long beards, nothing but skin and bone, wild staring eyes, and countenances fierce, barbarous, unwashed, and infected with human gore.
Like, that's some Cradle of Filth shit.
Yeah, somebody burned a church after they said that.
Directly after saying that. Dean begged Stover to take the men back to the mainland, but the canoe would capsize with two men in it. With the weather turning stormy again, Stover promised he would come back to rescue the castaways. The men begged him for a fire before he left, and it was the least Stover could do. After Stover left back for the mainland, the men used the fire to cook the breast meat of their former carpenter.
They got fucking rescued, and all they wanted was a fire to cook more human.
Yeah, like imagine that. Imagine that. That, like, that's so fucked. Because as we talked about before, they can see ships. Like this whole time for 24 days, they can just see ships. They're not like totally stranded away from civilization. And they just can't access them. And then somebody just, because of the dead body that sacrificed themselves and washed up on shore, somebody actually comes out. They're rescued. Somebody has come. But then because it's the fucking 1600s and they didn't come out with some like big fucking boat with a motor and all this shit where they can just be like, get on board, boys. He just has to leave. They have to just continue being stranded and continue eating dead bodies. After somebody finds them, they're just like, we still have to keep eating bodies. Like, that's so bleak.
Nah, dude. Just nah. Nah, dude.
Like, that's the moment in the movie where it's over. Somebody washes up and they're like, oh my God, we're saved. And then it's the end, cut to credits. And then it like has the little text, the text crawl that explains what happened to them afterwards and all this stuff. But then they still have to keep eating the corpses of their shipmates. That's so bleak. It took 3 days before the seas calmed down enough that a rescue attempt could be made. On January 4th, 1711, two boats arrived and rescued the men. They were taken to a tavern in Portsmouth, where they were fed slowly so as not to shock their bodies. A doctor tended to the men, cutting off several frostbitten fingers and toes. The most severe amputation was to the cabin boy, who lost half his foot. Dean recovered at a friend's house, where he immediately wrote his own version of the events, highlighting himself as the hero.
Fucking of course.
Which is just like such bullshit, because reading this story really gives you like, it really gives you a sense of like karma is real. Cause it's like, this guy was a total fucking asshole who just like was abusive and just beat the shit out of his crew members and was just a total fucking piece of shit. And then it's like, oh, and this is what you get. You get fucking stranded on an island for 24 days where you have to like fucking eat your crewmates and be exposed to abject fucking misery for 24 days or 27 days. And then to come out of that and be like, I was a hero. I was the one that had the idea to eat the carpenter.
No, just no.
Three crew members who were still ill signed it. Can you sign this?
Yeah, you know, can you just corroborate my story that I actually was a hero this whole fucking time? Thanks, K, bye.
And they were just like, fucking, I don't care. This was the most horrible experience of my entire life. And we survived. I'll sign your dick. Act 4, Boone Landing Conspiracies. When First Mate Christopher Langman was recovered, he returned to London with two other members of the crew. They published their own version of the events, portraying Captain Dean as cowardly, brutal, and a traitor. They put the blame of the shipwreck on him, as they would have reached Boston if he hadn't spent a week dilly-dallying off the coast of Newfoundland. He supposedly cried when they shipwrecked and was the first to suggest cannibalism. He even tried to give up the ship to French privateers on multiple occasions. The pamphlet ruined Dean's reputation and forced him out of London. Fucking good. What a piece of shit. This is like the 17th century version of cancel culture, where like there's this dude and he's like, I'm a fucking hero. And then some people come forward with accusations and it exposes the years of lies. So this isn't a new thing.
This, immune from future privilege.
Captain Dean got canceled. That's really funny to me, though. That's really funny to me to think of him as getting canceled. And you know he said the same shit, the same thing that people, whenever people get exposed for horrible things that they've done, and then they'll try to say that the people are like serial liars and they're just trying to get attention and fame. You know he said the same stuff. Although I would love, okay, so Captain Dean, they get rescued. Captain Dean writes his little pamphlet talking about how he's a hero or whatever. Everyone's like, oh my God, you're great. And then these two people come forward with these accusations. Cut to Captain Dean with a ukulele.
Definitely not a cannibal. Only thing I've cannibaled is my two cats.
Wait a minute. No, that doesn't work. Yes, I eat cats.
And then, of course, there's the wave of think piece, you know, reactions to his denial. Dean made it as a song so that he could copyright strike everybody so that no one can criticize him because we all know he's a fucking cannibal.
Oh yeah, the guy on Twitter who hypothesized that she did it in song form so that nothing that she said could be admissible in court because she could claim that it was like parody or something like that.
I mean, she literally did do it in order to issue copyright strikes to people. Ethan Klein played it on his podcast and she issued a copyright strike.
Oh yeah, 100%. Yeah, she put it on iTunes as like a song too, which is like insane. Like, that's insane. Like, there's no better example of like the horrors of late stage capitalism than somebody makes a 10-minute song addressing child grooming accusations and then turns it into a 99-cent iTunes single. Like, that's insane.
It's in fucking sane.
Oh my God. Man, maybe we don't have future privilege after all. Maybe it was better when you just fucking got lost at sea and had to eat your friend. Maybe that was better.
I mean, as long as it's me eating you, fine, sure. Because I want to survive with that horrible survivor's guilt. You know, that's my new kink. I'm looking for that survivor's guilt. I know it's taken me like 2 years to get over Andrew's death, but I want to get over Spandrew's death in like a year and a half.
Yeah, we'll be like that one German guy who he put out a Craigslist ad looking for somebody who wanted to be killed and eaten. And then somebody responded to it and consensually allowed themselves to be killed and eaten. And it was like a sexual thing slash like a it was like a sexual thing slash like he wanted to commit suicide, basically. And then the German guy was arrested. It'll be like that.
It already is like that. This podcast is just like years of foreplay.
Mm-hmm. And then eventually, yeah, you cut off my penis and fry it and we eat it together.
Who's to say we already haven't?
Yeah, I mean, I can't say anything publicly, but yeah, you have a point. In 1714, Dean joined the Russian Navy and took command of the Yagudil, a 50-gun warship. That's like him, like, going to Russia and joining the Navy is like that's the equivalent of Army Hammer being spotted selling timeshares in the Cayman Islands.
Yeah, dude. Yeah.
The next year, he was given the sleeker 32-gun warship Samson. He was a skilled captain and led over 20 successful raids on enemy ships, gaining the attention of Admiral Fyodor Apraskin, commander of the Baltic Fleet. But in 1717, Dean did something that gave further credence to the pamphlet that Langman published in London. That year, the Samson raided two Swedish commercial ships that were traveling through the Gulf of Danzig. Mothers, tell your children not to eat their friends.
Because if you want to chow down on me, at least there's fire.
I got something to say. I ate a carpenter today. Doesn't matter much to me as long as he tasted good. The raid was interrupted by a Royal Navy frigate and a Dutch man of war, which demanded that Dean give up the two vessels. Clearly overpowered, he was forced to give up the ships. While some saw it as Dean doing the smart thing, he was accused of accepting a bribe in exchange for surrendering the two Swedish ships. He was court-martialed, and even though 11 officers supported his testimony, Dean was found guilty. He was dismissed from service with a year in prison. The Tsar lessened the sentence to a demotion to lieutenant and forced to lead a timber ship in the remote Russian region of Kazan. During the trial, Admiral Fyodor Apraskin attempted to get Dean out of Russia by giving him a passport. After the end of the Great Northern War in 1721, Dean was discharged from the Russian army and warned to never return to Russia. Dang, double canceled.
Yeah, dude.
After his dismissal from the Russian army, Dean used his inside knowledge of Russia to write two detailed reports to the British government. What a fucking dick.
This guy fucking sucks, man. This guy fucking sucks.
He's like, he defects to Russia because he gets canceled in Britain. And then he gets canceled in Russia. And he's like, I've got some fucking tea on these guys. Or I got some vodka, I guess. An account of affairs in Russia, June to July 1725, regarded the political fallout following the death of Peter the Great. His second was The Present State of the Maritime Power of Russia, which gave details on the Baltic Fleet. He later intercepted a Jacobite courier who was on his way to deliver classified intelligence regarding their spring attack plans to another agent in Rotterdam. This, in addition to his Russian reports, brought him to the attention of Prime Minister Robert Walpole. The Secretary of State for the Northern Department, Charles Townsend, 2nd Viscount Townsend, promoted Dean to British Consul to the port of Ostend. The British government provided him with an annual salary of £200 plus expenses, which was very good at the time. After 8 years at the position, Dean retired in 1736 at the age of 57. Got away scot-free with all that bullshit, plus got to retire at 57?
Well, for context, 57 in the 1700s is like 103.
Yeah, 57 is like, I'm dying next month.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I know that, but that was the joke, because getting to retire at 57 now is probably mostly unheard of. Like, we were staying at a hotel somewhere on our trip that we just went on, and there was like one of the hotel staff, like a janitor, and this dude easily was like 87. And I was like, Jesus, this is fucking bleak. If I'm 87 and I have to work at a hotel as a janitor or like a cleaning staff or whatever, that would be so fucked up. Dean died at the age of 83 in 1762 following an assault and battery in the fields near his home. Well, I mean, he lived to 83.
He lived to 83, bro. What the fuck?
And also, he was murdered. He didn't die of old age or some kind of disease. He was murdered at the age of 83. For a man whose crew testified that he was cruel and barbaric to them, it seems a fitting end to a man who seemed to constantly fail upward. I mean, on one hand, yes, fitting end that he died from getting fucking bludgeoned to death like he did to multiple of his crew. But also, in the 1700s, he got to live to 83. Like, this guy did not get his fucking comeuppance. He skated through controversy after controversy. And despite just being a horrible piece of shit, he got to live to the ripe age of 83 in the 1700s. And then, yes, was beaten to death. But, like, for the most part, he did not get his karmic comeuppance for the shit he did.
So, I guess, you know, final thoughts. For me, I would say my final thoughts are, this isn't quite as terrifying to me as the Titan submersible Titanic thing. Like, being trapped in a, you know, a tiny, tiny, tiny space with like three or four other people and like slowly suffocating to death. But I would say that this is a not too distant set close second. You know, I don't think I like the idea of being marooned on an island, slowly being worn down by the elements and forced to contemplate ingesting my friends. That sounds pretty fucking bad. The other thing about this that's really disturbing is the fact that Dean had no fucking real comeuppance. Not only did he, like, completely fuck this up, but then when he went rogue and became a Russian whatever, they also were like, gave him a second shot, and then he fucked that up, and then bounced from there, and then there's no justice for the wicked, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a big takeaway from this. And I think we've talked about this on the show before. I think this has definitely been a conversation. This idea that, you know, 100 years of cinematic storytelling has conditioned us to this idea that, like, bad people get their, you know, get their comeuppance in the end. Like, eventually your luck is going to run out and you're going to get, you know, some kind of karmic reward for being a shitty person. And, you know, that's due to the sort of like structure of a movie that has to wrap up in the end and have an ending and all that stuff. And everything has to be kind of balanced and fit within a structure. But in real life, while that does frequently happen, there are also probably just as many or more times that we don't really know about where somebody just did the most despicable shit on the planet. And then they just lived their lives and died of old age and nothing really happened to them.
Yeah. I mean, an annoying, frustrating degree of that. Yeah. I mean, this is a perfect example of it. Where it's just like, this guy, like, forever altered, scarred, and caused the death of all of these dudes, you know, 24 men or whatever. Like, that's fucking brutal. And also, like, what an egomaniac that he made all these mistakes, almost died out there, and then was like, I'm just gonna go be a captain again.
And also that, like, because that's the thing, is like the whole thing that whenever Travis Barker from Blink-182 and that DJ, they got into a plane crash, like, I would never get on a plane again, ever. And he didn't for a while. Travis Barker didn't, he didn't fly on a plane for years, but he just recently got onto a plane. Like, in the last, sometime this year, he got onto a plane for the first time since 2013 or whenever that happened. I would never get on a plane again. So not only did this dude, like, this happened to him, shipwrecked, and then he's like, I'm just going to be a captain again. Not only that, but, like, he was fine. He just did that for years and was fine, and nothing ever happened again. And then he died when he was 83.
And he didn't even die of old age. Motherfucker got murdered.
Probably deservedly so. He probably just pissed off the wrong dude.
Well, on that note, I'm Dave Baker.
And I'm Spandrew Spice.
This has been Deep Cuts. If you'd like to find me online, you can do so at heydavebaker.com, or you can get issues of Halloween Boy, Everyone is Tulip, Forest Hills Bootleg Society, Star Trek 7, Voyager 7's Reckoning, and all my other books. Also, right now, there's a pre-order campaign going for Mary Tyler Moorhawk, my new book, which comes out on February 13th, 2024.
MTMH!
MTMH, baby! If you'd like to pre-order it on Amazon, it's available there. Or if you'd like to pre-order it through Golden Apple Comics, you can do that. And you're going to get some goodies, a little signed book plate from me, and some other cool stuff.
People were talking about Mary Tyler Moorhawk in the Discord a while back. It was probably, at this point, it was probably like 3 or 4 weeks ago. But somebody made the joke. They were talking about Mary Tyler Moorhawk. They were saying, like it was sometime you plugged it or mentioned it on the show. And then they were talking about it and saying, like, oh, that sounds cool. I don't remember what the conversation was, but somebody made the joke of saying Mary Tyler Moorcock. And I wanted to be like, that was originally what it was called.
Well, it's not actually accurate, right? Because you remember the first incarnation of it was like Mary Tyler Moorcock was like a Columbo, Mr. Magoo detective old woman. And her name was Mary Tyler Moorcock. And, like, that was the joke. But didn't really go anywhere. It wasn't very good. It just kind of evolved over the course of it.
But I just thought it was funny because someone thought they were, like, being so, like, clever. And they were just like, Mary Tyler Moorhawk, more like Mary Tyler Moorcock. I was like, that was the origin of it. I was there.
So silly. So silly. Yeah. Spandrew, where can people find you on the internet?
You can't find me on the internet because I don't use social media. But if you want to pay your respects to the dear beloved Papa Pricey, you can get his book, Deadbolt AI Private Eye, by going to dapricewrites.com. You can also go to deepcutspod.com, where you can pick up merch and other cool stuff from Deep Cuts, shirts, hats, t-shirts, shoulder patches, all that stuff. You can follow us on social media, going to Facebook, Deep Cuts Podcast, join our Facebook group, Deep Cuts Podcast Facebook group, where we talk about the show and make memes. You can join our Discord server, bit.ly/deepcutsdiscord, where we talk about the show, make memes, and do other cool stuff. Next episode, we're going to shout out all the people who got us to 500 on the number counting game. We're not going to do it this episode because we just didn't have time to put the names together, but we'll do it next episode, next week. You can follow us on Instagram at deepcutspod. You can follow us on TikTok at Mystery Treehouse. You can follow us on a voyage across the sea on our ship, where eventually we will crash and then Dave will eat me. Deep Cuts is a production by Boy Genius Media. If you'd like to find this show and others like it, please visit boygeniusmedia.com or deepcutspod.com.
If you want to join in on post-episode discussions, please join the Deep Cuts Podcast Facebook group. Finally, subscribe to our YouTube channel for additional video content.
The incidental music for this episode was created by D. Catalano, whose music can be found at wekeepoddhours.bandcamp.com. This episode of Deep Cuts was written by special guest writer Tim Madura. If you'd be interested in writing an episode of the show, please email Andrew at boygeniusmedia.com.